Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
And welcome back from a long Thanksgiving weekend. Hope you had a great holiday, great Thanksgiving with your family. If it's a holiday that you celebrate, I suspect most of our listeners do. Tom Hartman here with you. From the wire services, as we like to say. Officials from a major food exporter in China apologized to American consumers today for shipping over 70 million poisonous turkeys to the U.S. early last week, but indicated it was too late for the recall of their toxic food product. Spokesman for the Wuhan Food Exportation Company said that while the company deeply regretted the shipment, the error was not discovered until Friday morning, making a recall of the Thanksgiving birds virtually impossible. The spokesman said it would be problematic to recall such a massive shipment. Those turkeys were sent to virtually every store in the U.S. At a press conference on Saturday to discuss what went wrong with the shipment of turkeys, Wuhan officials revealed that the birds have been fed an experimental combination of birdseed, lead pellets, and date rape drugs. Going forward, said Q Liang Wang, the company's public relations director, we're going to skip the lead pellets. In an attempt to regain the confidence of the American consumer, Kui said that in the future, all turkeys shipped to the U.S. would include a warning label, but under tough questioning from reporters, he conceded that the label would be printed in Chinese. At the conclusion of the press conference, Kui indicated that he was confident that the company could regain U.S. consumers' trust in time for the Christmas season. He said, we have 80 million delicious Christmas hams just waiting to be shipped. That's actually from Andy Borowitz, the Borowitz Report. BorowitzReport.com, the website with permission, but it raises an issue. I mean, here's this communist country engaging in capitalism, which raises some, a former Maoist communist country raises some interesting questions. Let's ask Raymond Latta about this. Raymond Latta is a Maoist political economist. He's the author of two books, America in Decline and Maoist Economics and the Revolutionary Road to Communism. The websites engage with BobBavakian.com and ThisIsCommunism.com. Raymond, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on. I'm glad to be able to talk about this statement, engage. Engage with BobBavakian, Dangerous Times Demand Courageous Voices. BobBavakian is such a voice. And, BobBavakian is the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and he is a visionary thinker and leader.
And he is in hiding.
BobBavakian is giving leadership to the revolutionary movement here, and he's making extraordinary theoretical contributions. And Avakian is keeping a very close pulse on the situation facing the masses in this country and around the world, and he is able, as I said, to give leadership to the revolutionary movement, and his work is something that is the centerpiece. His contribution in terms of the vision that he's bringing forward about a different world. And
but, Raymond, you're going on and on here. The guy's in hiding. How do we know that any of this is true? First of all, and secondly, what's the vision that we're not talking with BobBavakian, we're talking with you. What is your vision for a Maoist America? I mean, what are you suggesting should happen here?
Okay, first of
all. Or for that matter, what is BobBavakian suggesting should happen here?
Okay, first of all, let's talk about what Avakian is doing. Avakian is charting a path for revolution in this country, and he is bringing forward...
That looks like what?
A vision. He's bringing forward a vision of a socialist and communist society, a society in which, on the one hand, people's basic needs can be met, in which the resources of society are being used, to solve basic problems, what we're talking about, housing, putting an end to exploitation, education, meeting the health needs of people... A society that can do that on a cooperative and collective basis, but at the same time, a society that is full of vitality and ferment.
You want to do this the way that Mao Zedong did it in China?
Well, what Avakian is doing in his work is summing up the experience of what he calls the first wave of socialist revolution. And these are the revolutions that took place in the Soviet Union and in China. These were the first attempts by oppressed humanity to build societies free from exploitation, to build societies in which the masses of people, those who've been kept on the bottom...
But Raymond Lotta, it didn't quite work out that way.
But now, well, there are great achievements in these revolutions.
Well, there were millions of people killed. I mean, Stalin killed 20 million people. Mao killed, what, 5, 10, 15 million? I don't know. How many million people did Mao kill in the Cultural Revolution?
Look, these revolutions involved uprisings of the oppressed against an old social order, an order that had been killing people repeatedly, killing people through famines, killing people through persecution, killing people through savage
exploitation. So it got replaced by a regime that killed people with guns.
These revolutions, you know, brought to power the oppressed. There was leadership that was leading people to build a new economy, a new society, new political structures that would empower people to...
Then why have the... Raymond, respectfully, you're first of all... No, I'm not going to. It's very nice, but this is not for given speeches. We're going to have a conversation about this. And you're speaking in the most broad generalities. First of all, what do you want to happen in the United States?
What we're talking about here is a vision of a different kind of society here in the United States and throughout the world.
Okay, you're calling for revolution. Revolution in the Soviet Union. Revolution in the Soviet Union. Don't make me put you on hold here, Raymond. Revolution in the Soviet Union happened, you know, as a consequence of the execution of the Tsar and his family and, you know, the seizure of government by Stalin. In Mao, you know, taking over China, the Maoist revolution, you call yourself a Maoist political economist. In both cases, these were revolutions where the people, in quotes, the people that you're calling on, executed the people who were the heads of government. Is that what you're calling for here in the United States?
What we're talking about here is a change in a social and economic system, a change that brings those who had been on the bottom of society into a position in which they are able, empowered by new structures, to change the relations of the economy, to change the ways in which people relate to each other, and, as I said, to tackle the most fundamental problem.
Broadly speaking, I don't think anybody would disagree with that. I mean, this could be Republican talking points. You know, it is so vague and so general. The fact that, you know, why is it, if Maoism is so good, that China has abandoned it? Why is it that if communism is so good, that the Soviet Union fell apart?
The Chinese Revolution accomplished extraordinary things. Life expectancy doubled from 32 years of age to 65 years of age. The infant mortality rate in Shanghai in 1975 was lower than that of New York City. In 1949, China only had 12,000 doctors trained in Western medicine. By 1965, there were 200,000 doctors trained in Western medicine. 4 million people would die each year of infectious diseases. This ended through that revolution. But more than that, that revolution created a situation in which you were beginning to break down the divisions between those who are working with their hands and those who are working with their minds, in which you were bringing peasants and workers into the universities, in which students were going to the countryside to share knowledge.
Raymond, I lived in China for a month in 1986 in
Beijing.
It was the tail end of the Cultural Revolution. Mao was dead, but that was not
a socialist revolution. In 1976, this revolution was defeated. And what Avakian is doing, and again, the subject of our discussion is, you know, what Avakian is bringing forward. Avakian has analyzed what were the strengths and what were the weaknesses of this first wave of revolutions, how it was that they were able, on the one hand, to produce the kind of achievements that I'm talking about, but at the same time...
So how were they?
...problems and shortcomings in the case of China. And what Avakian is emphasizing is that we have to bring forward a new model of social society. This is what he's talking...
Can you give us just one specific... We have 30 seconds left. One specific?
Well, he's talking about the importance of dissent. in socialist society. The fact that you,
but so do Republicans.
On the one hand, you want to be moving in a collective way forward to overcome all of these inequalities and these scars of the old society. You want to be doing that, and at the same time, you want to unleash all kinds of creativity, all kinds of ferment. You want to have a flowering of imagination. You want to have people who can criticize at all levels.
It sounds wonderful. Raymond Lotta, engage with BobAvakian.com. This is communism.org, the website's. Raymond, thanks for dropping by today. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. Well, okay. There are few. It amazes me to watch mainstream media, particularly on the weekends when you have the weekend shows, but also, you know, the commentary shows and whatnot. And they go, "Are you guys on the left?" Well, you just heard from the real left. The real left. And, you know, I was hoping we could get to some actual specifics. You know, Avakian, for example, suggests that the Democratic Party is not a party of the people, but serves one sector of the capitalist ruling class. This is from his Wikipedia entry, that the United States contains oppressed nations. It's a disputed idea in the communist way. Anyhow, there are some interesting ideas here that I would have liked to have drilled into, but our guest seemed more committed to making a speech, unfortunately. But here's the bottom line. Lay this stuff out on a spectrum. And where on the one hand you have let me back up a little bit. Lay out on a spectrum how we value labor, because that's really what all this comes down to. What is labor worth? How do we pay people? How do we make sure that people are paid appropriately? On one end of the spectrum is the libertarian argument, the Ron Paul argument, that labor is purely a matter of private contract. That an individual will be paid whatever somebody is willing to pay him or her to do whatever the job is that person is capable of doing, and if they're not capable of doing it, they won't get paid. In other words, society has no interest in the issue. That's the libertarian argument. That's the extreme right-wing argument. That's the Ron Paul argument. There should be no minimum wage. There should be no floor through which people cannot fall. And if people are poor and hungry and starving, even if they're working a full, you know, 40, 50, 60, 80-hour week, tough luck. They should have gotten smarter. They should have been born with a better brain and gotten a PhD, or they should have been born with a stronger body and been able to sell their labor for more, or they should have been born during a time when there were fewer people competing for the same number of jobs, and therefore the cost of labor went up. Now, that's one end of the spectrum. On the other end of the spectrum is the belief, the absolute belief, that every single person in society who's willing to participate in society to the extent that they can, obviously there's some exceptions here, you know, people who are severely disabled and whatnot, you know, taking them out of the equation, making sure that they're provided for as well, but taking them out of the labor equation, that every single person is willing to work. If they're willing to work, then we guarantee that the fruit of their labor, that is the wage that they make, is enough that they can have a decent standard of living. This, by the way, was a suggestion that was put forward by Adam Smith in Wealth of Nations in 1776. In fact, he suggested that the decent living part of it was something that should be culturally defined. He used the example of how in England everyone wore shoes, whereas in Scotland it was not uncommon and it was not considered humiliating to go barefoot. So he said in Scotland, the wage should be enough that somebody can go barefoot. In England, the wage should be enough that somebody can buy shoes. This is the actual example that, Adam Smith used in Wealth of Nations in 1776. So at the founding of this country, there was the argument that there should be some way, that society should intervene in some way to make sure that if somebody is working a full-time job, however society defines that. Again, Adam Smith says, over time, that will be defined differently by different societies as well. Right now, we define that as a 40-hour week. If somebody's working a full-time job, that their wage will not drop below the point where they can have a decent standard of living, where they can own a home, where they can raise a family. Well, actually, however you define that. Now, Teddy Roosevelt, the Republican Roosevelt, 1901 to 1908, Teddy Roosevelt was the guy who first came up with the idea when he put forward his Square Deal proposal of a what he called a living wage. He came up with the phrase living wage. I don't think anybody would accuse Teddy Roosevelt of being communist. Well, actually, I shouldn't say that, because there are a lot of Republicans since then have accused him of being communist. But nonetheless, he said that there is a moral definition of this, and that a living wage is enough that you could put your kids through school, you could buy a home, you could save for your retirement, you could cover your medical expenses, you could take a vacation every year. He laid it right out. So that's at the other end of the spectrum. So here we have the spectrum where, and the problem that was encountered in the USSR, for example, where it was, hey, if you work, you get paid. Don't worry about it. And, you know, I recall visiting there and like, I couldn't get a taxi because the taxi drivers got paid whether they drove people around or not. So it's like these two extremes. What you see is that it breaks down at either level. The Ron Paul extreme, the libertarian extreme, what you end up with is god awful poverty, grinding poverty. That's the direction we've been moving in. The total communist extreme, or as it was acted out in the Soviet Union, as many communists would disavow that as communism, but nonetheless, that's how it's been acted out, how it's functioned. That doesn't seem to work either, because it creates a disincentive for work. So there's got to be some kind of a middle ground. And that's where America was from the mid-1930s to the mid-1980s, when Reagan came along and said, no, we're going to pull out that middle ground and go back to that Ron Paul libertarian way of thinking. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
This is your home for progressive talk. AirAmericaRadio.com.
Four minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Let me just put a fine point on this, and then we'll pick up your phone calls here. The first is that liberals, in quotes, and I proudly count myself among them, are described in the mainstream media as being the left in the United States. And the point of my riff in the just before the break is that we're not the left. We're the center. In the United States, the left is the old Communist Party, or the new Communist Party, or the new Revolutionary Communist Party, and that left is, you know, is relatively marginalized in the United States compared with the right in the United States, which has, frankly and startlingly and frighteningly, a lot of power. But the mainstream media keeps, you know, weirdly insisting that, you know, we're the left. No, we're the middle. So point number one. Point number two, how much are you willing to pay for cultural overhead? That's really the question that I think much of this raises. In addition to the question of should pay be defined by the standards of morality on the one end of the spectrum or by the standards of marketplace economies, purely supply and demand. So is it economics or morality with regard to the price of labor? And my argument is it's both. But nonetheless, cultural overhead. Societies with little cultural overhead are the original leisure societies. Everybody works, but nobody works particularly hard. You see this among Aboriginal and Indigenous people all over the world. They typically, people in hunting-gathering societies, for example, work about 2 hours a day. because there's no cultural overhead. That is to say, there are very few members of the society who are capable of working who are not working. Now, as cultural overhead starts increasing, cultural overhead being those people who are capable of being productive, but their time is being used by something else. They are priests, for example, which is not producing something that is quantitatively productive. Or they are members of a ruling elite. They are members of government in a part of government, a dimension of government that's not specifically producing something of value. That is, it's not the part of the government that is the police department. It's not the part of government that is building roads. It's not the part of government that's educating people. A great example is Louis XIV in France. The French Revolution was fought against Louis XIV and Marie Antoinette. And there was this incredible palace at Versailles, this incredibly lavish lifestyle while they were having bread riots in France. I mean, people literally, when bread was made, people would riot at the stores to get it because they were starving to death. And Louis XIV's response to this was, well, you know, we have to make the palace even fancier, and Marie has to even have fancier parties because that's the national pride. In other words, the money that was being spent to maintain his lifestyle was being justified as the prestige of the nation. This is what I refer to as cultural overhead. As cultural overhead increases, then the amount of work everybody else has to do to support it also increases. And the French eventually said the cultural overhead, Louis XIV's palace and lifestyle, is more than they're willing to pay. Particularly when they were having bread riots. Today, cultural overhead in the United States is largely represented by churches and government. Churches are a voluntary form of cultural overhead, except for their impact on property and income tax collections. Government is an involuntary form of cultural overhead. And I am not a libertarian who's arguing against government. I'm simply pointing this out. And here's the problem with government as it is being run by Republicans. And there's a great article in Vanity Fair this month about this. They're talking specifically about one particular defense contractor, but it points this out. If you take the income taxes, federal income taxes, paid by every single person in America who's earning $100,000 a year or less, 94% of us, if you take the income taxes from 94% of us, everybody in America earning $100,000 a year or less, that's the amount of money that is now given by the federal government to private contractors. And I would submit to you that those private contractors are doing jobs that we used to have government bureaucrats do, but they're doing them for two or three times the cost. So we've got these huge palaces of wealth, these Louis XIV palaces of wealth. We call them corporate contractors. And that's the new form of cultural overhead in our society. And it's frankly on the edge of bringing us down. Paul in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Paul, welcome to the program. Paul? No Paul. Okay, let's try Michael in Glendale, Arizona. Hey, Michael, you're on the air.
Hello, how are you, David?
I'm fine. This is Tom.
Oh, Tom, I'm sorry. Jeez, I always make that mistake. First of all, I want to congratulate you. I think you have an excellent program, and you are pretty fair to your guests, and me, I'm an opposing political spectrum from you, but I still really enjoy listening to you, and I think that's a kudos to you.
Thank you.
Gee, you just brought up a whole bunch of other things. How about if I stay on topic to before your latest speech, where you characterized the spectrum being far right libertarianism on one hand and far left communism. First of all, you said that communism has the problem of disincentive to work. That's not why.
Right, and libertarianism has the problem of poverty. Every time societies have been organized in a libertarian fashion, I mean, look at Victorian era England, what you have is massive poverty and virtually no middle class. And every time societies have been organized in a communist way, societies larger than a kibbutz, societies where it's large, where there's enough people that it's possible for anonymous predators to, you know, or slackers. To take advantage of the society, you end up with a society that an economy that doesn't work.
I'm sure you're familiar with an economic point called the calculation debate, and that's why or that's the theory of why socialism, communism cannot work.
I'm not, just, actually. I'm unfamiliar with that phrase. I'm sorry.
The calculation debate is basically that there is no objective way to set prices. You can't just hand
Are you talking about prices, or are you talking about the price of labor? Because I'm putting all of this in the frame of the price of labor. Yeah, no, I agree. There is no objective way to set external prices. But with regard to labor, because you don't say, okay, here's a car, it's worth $12,000 because people are willing to pay $12,000 for it, but morally, that car should be worth $15,000. You can't make that argument for goods or arguably for some services. But you can make that argument for labor, because labor is us. And the whole point of a society authorizing people to conduct business within that society is that that business ultimately will derive some benefit to the society.
Why do you bring up an abstract notion label of society as if that's something separate than us?
Well, I know that libertarians don't think that there is such a thing as society, that there's only family, to quote Margaret Thatcher, that there is only family and family units. There is no such thing as society at large. I disagree with that. I believe that there is such a thing as society at large, and particularly in a nation state, it's the nation at large. And there is an abstract and yet also concrete we there. I mean, how can you deny that?
Wouldn't that will or anything that you're attributing to society, these notions, aren't those naturally formed on the market?
No, not necessarily. In fact, this is my whole point, is that as soon as you say that labor has a moral value in addition to an economic value, then you're deviating from the marketplace. That's where libertarianism falls apart. In a purely libertarian world, labor has a value that's purely the function of the market, and that's why it always produces poverty, massive poverty, grinding poverty, exploitative poverty. When you say, wait a minute, labor has some intrinsic moral value, and we have to recognize that, therefore we're going to have minimum wage laws, therefore we're going to have laws that prevent children from working, from being part of the labor force, therefore we're going to allow unionization with the force of government behind it, then what you're doing is you're saying, yes, there is a moral value to labor, and there's an economic value to labor, and we're going to try and balance those two.
Economic value has to include moral value because it's determined by people, and people have moral values. When I determine to pay my lawnmower guy $10 to mow the lawn, there is a moral component.
Not because if somebody else comes along and says that they'll do it for $4, you would in all probability would say yes. I mean, this is what you're arguing against is what everybody sees right now in the whole illegal immigration thing. Is, you know, people saying, yeah, you know, I like the fact that I've got a guy who will do my lawn for $1.50 an hour. Isn't that great? And oh gee, we've got to get rid of these illegal immigrants. Tilt.
I didn't catch some of that last part. I'm sorry.
Oh, well, that's okay. Michael, I've got to move along, but I got your point, and I
appreciate it.
Yeah, we'll have to continue the conversation. Peter in San Francisco, we got about a minute left, Peter, before we got to take a break. What's up?
Yeah, I told your screener I was in China at the end of the Cultural Revolution in 1976, and we were in a delegation, and the question of violence and what was going on in China at that time was brought up, and we were told quite bluntly that in many areas the Communist Party cadre attempted to stop what was going on, but there was so much hatred and anger among workers and peasants because of what had happened prior to 49 that they could not stop it.
Yeah. At the same time, though, I mean, Mao was encouraging killing people who had any connection to society.
What's your source on that? And
there was actually a very good piece on the Discovery Channel last week about a guy who was making bows and arrows. You know, the old manufacturer. Well, I'll tell you after the break. 45 minutes past.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Yeah, yeah.
So, no, I'm not suggesting that my sole source of information about China is the Discovery Channel. It was a great example, though. They did the story on this guy whose family, for like 14 generations, had been the bow makers. These beautiful, exquisite, like bow and arrow bows for the, essentially the royalty of China. But it was also part of the cultural heritage. And they were declared heretics. It was illegal during the Cultural Revolution for this guy to even possess a bow. And people in his family were killed. And they had one bow that they hid, and they had to break it in half and stick it in the wood pile so that it wouldn't be found, and they kept it through the Cultural Revolution. And now he's making bows again, and he's teaching people how to do it. They're bringing back their culture. And, you know, I suppose the modern government sees this as a useful thing. But I'll tell you, the month that I spent in China back in the year of 1986, this was somewhat after the Cultural Revolution. This was after the frenzied killing was over. But I can tell you, the people that I interacted with, I spent a month at the Beijing International Acupuncture Hospital studying acupuncture. And the physicians that I interacted with, the locals that I interacted with, they were terrified of the government. And everywhere I went, I was followed. Everywhere any of the foreigners went, we were followed. And I just have to say, you know, it's not a society that I would want to live in. It's just, don't want it. Wouldn't want to do it. So, anyhow, 1-866-303-2270. Oh, Sansara's on the line with the Revolutionary Communist Party, right?
I am a supporter, yeah. How you doing,
okay.
Tom?
I'm fine. You said I mischaracterized what's his name's views. I'm not sure that he specified any views that could be characterized.
Well, Tom, I have to say, I like your show. I listen to your show. I was really disappointed with the interview. Because, look, Avakian and the Revolutionary Communist Party, you implied, are calling for, you know, which they are not, violence against individuals, execution. That's ridiculous.
I didn't imply that. I simply asked, and he didn't answer the question.
Okay, well, anyway, I'm calling because I think it's important to.
Okay, so
to
you're
clarify.
Saying that the Revolutionary Communist Party is not calling for revolution in the United States.
No, there's a difference between revolution is a serious matter and it needs to be approached in a serious and scientific way, not through infantile and individual acts of frustration and violence. They're very different things. In a revolutionary situation, a revolution, which is qualitatively different than the one we live in right now, a revolution is characterized by a mass uprising of millions of people who would, yes, have to meet and defeat the repressive force of the state. We're living in a country.
How?
That, you know, how? Well, look, this
how?
Is...
Very simple. I mean, I think of the Civil War was a revolutionary time in the United States. The
That's
Revolutionary
true.
War
That's
was obviously
true.
A revolutionary time
That's
in the United
true.
States. I'd say that Teddy Roosevelt was taking a revolutionary position when he started busting up big corporations. He was not particularly successful ultimately. And when he tried to run into the Bull Moose Party, all he did was consolidate corporate power. Ultimately, and Franklin
okay.
Roosevelt, I would say, took a very revolutionary position in the United States.
I would disagree with that because in the basic way, he leaves the state structures and the economic foundation intact. But he
fundamentally altered our culture. And I'm not sure that we want another Civil War type revolution in the United States.
But here's
don't.
The thing. Here's the thing, Tom. You said you wouldn't want to live in a society like China. And in 86, I agree. The revolution had been reversed, and there are truly horrors being brought back there by that time and increased since then. But if you look at the society we live in, the very rights that the right to free speech, the founding fathers, all these things established that you uphold and that I have some, respect for some of them, they rest on a foundation of originally in this country slavery and genocide down to today with wars of aggression, imperial plunder. You look at Iraq, and you were just talking about the culture. I mean, I just think this is very relevant. You were talking about the culture of bow making in China, which may or may not have been suppressed illegitimately, and this is part of actually the critique that Avakian's bringing forward, which I think would be interesting to engage. But you look at what this country did, the museums and the culture and the people of Iraq, as a matter of
It was
of
a crime.
Course,
it was a crime. And I think that, you know, Bush and buddies, and particularly Rumsfeld, should be in the docket at The Hague. But that's not the fact that the guys in charge in the case of Iraq committed a war crimes and crimes against humanity is not whether or not we should dismantle our society. It doesn't
But it does merit. It does make it pretty legitimate to me.
So how do you go about dismantling our society, Sansara?
It does raise a profound and legitimate question of what does the war crimes and crimes against humanity that this government carried out in Iraq, does it have something to do with the foundations and even the concepts of bourgeois democracy on which this country is founded?
It probably does. It certainly does. It certainly does. Okay. So how do you go about changing it?
Well, I think one of the things is, and this is a bigger conversation, and it is going up against conventional wisdom, which is one of the reasons why the Engage statement, Dangerous Times Demand Courageous Voices, was published, is to actually, there's a tremendous body of work that Avakian has done to resynthesize, recast, build off of the experience so far in socialist revolutions before they were reversed in China and the Soviet Union, and to recast that in light of, yes, some real shortcomings.
But answering a specific question with a response that says there's an enormous body of work, that's never going to filter down to the masses of the people, to the average person to say, okay, there's an enormous body of work, therefore I'll go out and put my life on the line.
Well, no. The whole point, I mean, my understanding is that the
what do we do first?
Pardon me?
What do we do first?
Well, one of the things is to build resistance and struggle against the outrages of the system today.
To create what?
The wars, the crimes. Pardon me?
I'm with you on that. To create
what? Yeah, no, I know. And we've worked together on some of that.
But the question is to create what?
To stop some of the crimes being done and change
sure.
people's conditions today, and B, to open up some room and some possibilities and forge unity among different sections of people, and an opening up an engagement about revolutionary alternatives. That's another thing that needs to be done.
Yeah.
And you and me can have differences on what kind of society we want to fight to bring into being, but there ought to be some atmosphere where that gets engaged fairly.
Sure, I'm not disagreeing. I'm just saying that if we don't talk about specifics, then we're just...
Well, I'll talk about specifics.
You know,
I think they're very important.
Yeah,
I think, people should have the right to eat. I think that can be guaranteed in the...
I agree with you, Sansara. And I'm sorry, we're the hour is over, but 57 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio, where smart people get their news.
And welcome back. Okay, let's you know, cut away from all the abstract notions, things like the cultural overhead, the cost of cultural overhead. In other words, how much are you willing to pay so that contractors can pay their CEOs hundreds of millions of dollars a year? Or tens of millions. Or the debate over whether labor has a moral... The cost of labor should be defined by morality or by a supposed marketplace, by purely supply and demand. And just cut right to the chase here. The bottom line is we are witnessing... It's right in front of our very eyes. We are witnessing the cancer stage of laissez-faire capitalism, where it reaches the point where it starts to implode upon itself. Now, where I differ from the communists is that I suggest that that does not indict capitalism per se. It indicts laissez-faire capitalism. But the capitalism and free enterprise within a regulated environment, so that in particular the cost of labor is always moral, or the pay to labor, let's say, the reimbursement of labor, is always moral, is something that's doable. And that, in fact, we did in this country for 40 years, although, again, as with everything else from the very founding of this country, we did it imperfectly, but we did get rid of slavery eventually. And we did eventually bring more, you know, again, obviously, we're still not there yet, but more people into the labor market. First women, then, you know, and the Civil Rights Act, now increasingly minorities. And yes, there's a long way to go, but I don't think that you get there by tearing everything down and throwing it up in the air and saying, let's start over again. Didn't work in Cambodia, didn't work in China, didn't work in Russia, and you know, frankly, I don't think it'll work here. Show me one country that has had a communist revolution and is better for it. Or, for that matter, show me a country that has gone totally libertarian and it's better for it. The middle ground is the place. And the greatest example of this right now, there's two. One has to do with the housing market, which I'm going to get to in just a second. And the other is our piggies alert for the day.
It's 291 billion pounds, Dr. Calculus.
Well, let me see. That would be 145 million and a half tons of the...
Refuse.
Yeah, refuse per every day. And by the year, let me figure, over 53 million tons of...
Manure?
Manure, yeah. By comparison, the pyramid of the pharaoh Cheops weighs about 690 million tons, which means that every four and three, you've got a pile of this,
excrement.
Yeah.
Have you seen the bigger piggies in the starched white shed? You will find the bigger piggies staring at you.
It's those bigger piggies in the starched white shirt that are putting out the information that the Fireside Theater was warning us about. And Trent Lott wants to do even more. Minority Senate Minority Whip Trent Lott is going to resign his seat before the end of the year. Why? Apparently so that he can get around this provision that goes into law at the first of the year, or at the end of this year. I'm not sure if it happens, if it becomes effective December 31st or January 1st, but basically on at some point in that 24-hour period, if you're a senator and you want to become a wealthy lobbyist like Fred Thompson was for years and years and you know, make millions and millions of dollars, you have to be out of the Senate for 2 full years before you can go to work for a lobbying firm starting next year. But if you leave the Senate this year, you can start lobbying your buddies the day after tomorrow. So Trent Lott is going to resign his seat. And this, as I said, this is a sign in my mind of hitting this cancer stage where there are no regulations, where there are no rules, where it's a world of predators and prey, where the so-called free market is defining everything. In this case, the free market for influence over democracy. This is wrong. I think it's entirely appropriate that we, the people, that a government of, by, and for the people, to the extent that this is, and we need to work aggressively on a daily basis to make it more so, that a government of the people should protect itself from the predators among the people who would seek to destroy it. And I would put Trent Lott into that category. And all these others who are taking all this corporate money and pushing the corporate agenda. I would say that the other part of this, so what we're seeing here is the failure of deregulation. In the case of Trent Lott, the deregulation of politicians, or the deregulation of corporate behavior relative to politicians. In the case of the housing market, it's the deregulation of the mortgage industry. This from today's Financial Times. A California hedge fund has made a more than 1,000% return this year by betting against U.S. subprime home loans, making it one of the world's best performing funds of all time. This guy in Santa Monica, Andrew Landy, or L-A-H-D-E, I'm not sure how he's pronounced, Lade, maybe, set up this fund. Hey, you can invest in my fund, you know, put in the money, and we'll go out and bet against subprime mortgages. And there's 1,000% return on investment. He's starting now to pay back his investors, by the way, saying it's time to stop this game because maybe this is... You know, maybe it's reached as bad as it's going to get. Now, these are my words, not his, but this is the conclusion that's drawn by the Financial Times today. And I don't think so. I think it's going to get worse. I think it's going to get a lot worse. There was a piece in the New York Times over the weekend, Robert Shiller. It's called A Time for Bold Thinking on Housing. And he says, he starts it out, he says, we have to consider the possibility that the housing price downturn will eventually be as big as that of the last truly big decline from 1925 to 1933, when prices fell by a total of 30%. And I read that and I was like, 1925? You know, we all know about the Great Depression, the stock market collapse in 1929. What I think most Americans don't realize is that the stock market crash in 1929 arguably was brought about in large part because of the housing crash of 1925, which started in Florida. In the fall of Florida, in the fall in Florida, fall of 1925 in Florida, the real estate was exploding. In Miami, they had to pass a law making it illegal for people to offer to buy or sell real estate standing on the street. That's how wild it was. It's all this speculation. And the market for the previous 5 years has just been getting stronger and stronger and stronger under what was referred to then as the Coolidge prosperity. And then the market crashed. And housing prices in Florida just, you know, went through the floor. They were dropping 10, 20, 30%. And nationwide, in fact, they went down 30%. I mean, housing prices just right across the board crashed. And as a consequence of that, we slid into the Great Depression. So now we're having housing prices in the United States. There's a piece in today's, A piece in today's New York Times, as I recall, that's talking about it was in the Wall Street Journal, about how the car market, the automotive companies in the United States are going to be facing very, very difficult times, or maybe, because the housing market is crashing, because people have been using their homes as the last source of cash, of income. Lawrence Summers in today's Financial Times, with the headline, Wake up to the dangers of a deepening crisis. He says several streams of data indicate now how much more serious the situation is than was clear a few months ago. Now, why did this all come about? And this is spreading, by the way. The New York Times did a piece about Detroit, Grosse Pointe, some of the fancy suburbs of Detroit, and how they're collapsing in value. How did this come about? It came about because capitalism moved into, as a consequence of Reaganism, as a consequence of this libertarian philosophy of absolute deregulation of the marketplace, capitalism is moving into its cancer stage. And the question is, are we going to excise the cancer by re-regulating capitalism? And in fact, regulating it more aggressively than we have, I would argue, since the mid-30s and perhaps even before that, certainly rolling back the idea of corporate personhood. And thus end up with a society where there is a strong middle class and people can become entrepreneurs? Or are we going to slide into a libertarian chaos, and out of that is what going to come? And I guess that what is the big question for the day. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
Ben Bernanke is the 14th chairman of the Federal Reserve.
Every breath you take, every change of rate, jobs you don't create, while we still stack fleet, I'll be watching you.
Oh, we're going to watch you, Ben Bernanke.
Every single day, Bernanke takes my pay. When growth goes away, inflation will stay, and I'll be watching you.
Yep, inflation is coming, I'm telling you.
Oh, can't you see?
First problem, he moves his lips.
Like a few more bips. When demand then dips and the yield curve flips, I'll be watching you.
Well, the yield curves flip back, but here's the bottom line. Here's how it works. Back the last time capitalism reached a cancer stage in the United States was the late 20s, under Coolidge and then Hoover. A couple of Republican presidents. What a surprise. Pursuing essentially libertarian economic policies. The government should play no role in the economy. And as a consequence, we had the Republican Great Depression. You had this housing bubble that blew up in the early 20s. It exploded in 25. It popped in late 25, early 26 in Florida initially, and then it spread across the United States. And this began reducing liquidity so that in 29, as the stock market was the new frenzy, that one popped. And, you know, everything went down for a decade. Now, how did we respond to that? I mean, there's some lessons here. Robert Shiller, writing in today's Wall Street Journal, I'm sorry, in Sunday's New York Times, points out that, you know, this era from 25 to 33, the housing prices fell, that there was a response to it. There was a federal response. And Robert Shiller says in 32, the National Association of Real Estate Boards proposed and Congress created the Federal Home Loan Bank System. That was step one. Now, this is when Hoover was still president. Then the real estate appraisal industry got its act together and said, okay, we're going to behave like professionals, not just shills for the banks. In 33, in the last days of the Hoover administration, Congress modified bankruptcy laws to allow insolvent wage earners to file to protect themselves from eviction from their own homes. Then Franklin Roosevelt comes into office in 33. Congress creates the Homeowners Loan Corporation to sponsor loans for those having trouble making payments, typically short-term mortgages. These are typically five-year mortgages, Robert Shiller writing in the New York Times. In 34, Congress created the Federal Housing Administration, Shiller points out. The FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, was created in 34. In 38, Congress creates Fannie Mae. So basically, we said, okay, we're gonna put together institutions that essentially are going to regulate the system and make it work. And what's the proof that that actually works? Well, Gretchen Morgenson, writing, I believe this was in yesterday's New York Times. I'm pretty sure it was the Sunday. I've clipped it out here. I don't have the top of the page. But the article is titled, Blame the Borrowers, Not So Fast. And she points out that there's this organization called Neighborhood Works America. This was created by Congress in 1978 to help poor people buy homes, basically. By poor people, the bottom end, the people who are earning, well, they've got over 3,000 loans out, totaling over $205 million. And quoting from Gretchen Morgenson, the incomes of these people average less than two-thirds of the national median income. 93% are first-time home buyers. 90% are low or moderate-income borrowers. Now, in other words, this is the exact profile of the people who are getting the subprime loans. But these are not subprime loans. These are fixed-rate loans and relatively low interest-rate loans. And, I mean, at the market. But as people are getting these loans as if they had good credit. In other words, they're getting the decent rates. And their delinquency figure... Now, keep in mind, subprime loans right now are almost 15% delinquencies nationwide. But for people who are borrowing from NeighborWorks America, the delinquency rate is a little over 3%, which is pretty much in the range of everybody else who gets a loan. 2.63% is the norm. In other words, if you loan to people with honesty and integrity, if you inform them of how the loan works, if you teach them about how the system works, if you give them the details of it, there's no gotchas, there's no penalties for prepayment, it's not set up to basically scam people, then those people actually are able to pay off the mortgages over time and they can buy their homes. It's not about the borrowers, it's about the lenders. And Gretchen Morgenson, in this column, I think it just absolutely lays this out, which takes us back to Reagan rolling back all the regulations that were in place, not just Reagan. I mean, we've had 27 years of this now, 28 years of it, 28 years of it. And it has moved us into this cancer stage where we're essentially eating our young. I mean, it's destroying America. And the remedy that the right would have? Less regulation. Don't worry. Let the market take care of it. Yeah, that's what Herbert Hoover said. It doesn't work. We need another Franklin Roosevelt. We need him now. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Ooh, and you're sweet.
Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Here's the scam that we've been running. We, the United States, with the rest of the world. This is the bigger frame. I started out this hour talking about the housing market, and then we'll pick up your phone calls here in just a second. I started this hour talking about the housing bubble and how in 1925, a housing bubble led to the stock crash of 29, and how this entire thing came about as a consequence of essentially capitalism, laissez-faire capitalism, unregulated, unrestrained, naked, raw capitalism moving into its cancer stage, which it inevitably does. And that cancer stage, the most singular aspect of that cancer stage is that the economy takes over the government, which is what we're seeing with Trent Lott right now, which is what we saw with Billy Towson when he pushed through the Medicare bill and then resigned to become a $2 million a year lobbyist for pharma. And this game that we've been playing with, as you know, Reaganism now, you know, nearly 30 years of pseudo libertarian philosophy, and I do have some knowledge of that. Back when Harry Brown was running for the Libertarian Party, back in the, as I recall, in the late 70s, in the mid 70s, I thought that was a great thing. I mean, I had his bumper sticker. It said "Freedom Works." You know, I have read extensively about libertarianism, I tell you, and the Libertarian Party, and been there, you know, back in Michigan, back in the day. And this philosophy that that Milton Friedman, I mean, really, it started with Friedrich von Hayek, and then Friedman picked up the mantle with the Chicago School, that it's impossible to regulate prices because you can never know the millions of details in the marketplace. Yeah, okay, there's some truth to that. But then, if you completely ignore the fact that marketplaces are not free, marketplaces are the creatures and creations of government, because the government creates the rules by which the marketplace operates. It creates the infrastructure on which it's the government is the soil in which a marketplace grows. It has to be there. If you have no infrastructure, you have no marketplace. So now we're seeing the housing bubble crash. We may see soon, and my guess is they're going to try and hold this together with spit and bubblegum and bailing wire until the elections are over in November. That's what they're trying to do. The Republicans are trying to do so they can drop the depression, the crash in the laps of the Democrats right after the election. But I don't think they're going to make it, frankly. I don't think it's going to, I don't think they're going to be able to hold this thing together for more than 3 to 6 months, but we'll see. I've been wrong before, but this housing bubble is only one small symptom of a larger issue. And this whole thing with Trent Lott, one small symptom of a larger issue, which is what happens when you say, okay, hands off the economy. We're not going to control. And therefore, economic forces can become the forces that are regulating or that are controlling democracy. Doesn't work. Here's the scam we've been running with the rest of the world. We have been saying to the rest of the world, we'll buy your stuff if you'll loan us the money to buy your stuff. It's real simple. It's like going to a car dealer and saying, I'll buy your car if you'll loan me the money. And the car dealers, by the way, are more than enthusiastic about doing that. The problem is, that assumes that you have some income, that you can pay back the loan. And instead, what we've been doing is we've just been saying, you know, every year we're going to go deeper in debt. This is what Reagan began, and this is where Dick Cheney says, you know, Reagan taught us that deficits don't matter. We are now $9 trillion in debt. That's just our federal debt. That's not our trades. Our trade deficit is absolutely massive as well. Trillions and trillions of dollars. And this just is now starting to break down. And I'm telling you, we are going to, I did this whole riff back on November 7th. I said, you're going to look back at this as the day. This is the day it began. And frankly, it's a little earlier than that. Wolfgang Munchau writing in today's Financial Times. And this is really a column that's worth reading. Dollar's last lap is the only anchor currency. He talks about how the financial flows in the U.S. appear to have come to a sudden stop. In other words, we're still buying stuff from the rest of the world, but they're not willing to loan us money anymore, which means that pretty soon, after we liquidate all our assets, like our houses, and they start losing their value because nobody else wants them, pretty soon we're going to have to stop buying all that stuff. And that's going to be worldwide recession or depression. And he says, to get an idea of this, this is look at the net purchases of long-term U.S. securities. That would be the difference between the foreign securities that are bought by Americans versus American securities bought by foreigners in foreign countries. And it's been running around an average of $70 billion a month throughout 2005. Every month, the world loaned us $70 billion. Or we bought $70 billion worth of stuff from the world that we paid for with debt. In 2006, it was running a little higher than $70 billion. In fact, in June of this year, it was $99 billion. That sounds great, right? I mean, you know, if you think that you can play that game forever, and the cons apparently think they can. But quoting Wolfgang Munchau from today's Financial Times, in June, this year was still a strong $99.9 billion, but that figure dropped to plus $19.5 billion in July, minus $70.6 billion in August, and back to plus only $26 billion in September. He notes, this sudden decline looks very much like a big structural shift. The scam is coming to an end because the rest of the world is saying, okay, we're not going to loan you the money anymore to buy our stuff. Or at least not in dollars, because you guys have debased the dollar. Anyhow, we're 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Ray in California. Hey, Ray.
Yeah, Tom. I would like to go back to what you were saying with your former guest earlier on about the revolution. Actually, it seems like I hear a lot about revolution on this show. And there's the communist revolutionary party sounded like they didn't really have, like you said, they weren't very specific. And in all due respect, I think the examples that you gave of the Roosevelt revolutions, both of them, Teddy and Franklin, were a little tepid. They weren't. Yeah, I think when I think of revolution, I think of a turning over, a complete turning over. And I think that the American electorate at this point in time almost has a responsibility to turn this thing around. And we have the capacity.
The conservatives argue that Reagan was a revolution. They refer to it as the Reagan Revolution. And in some ways, it was a turning over because it was a repudiation of the New Deal. I mean, this is
Roosevelt is dead.
Oh, Rush.
His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
I mean, you know, that's Limbaugh and his famous, Roosevelt is dead. But that was the point. I mean, we had 40 years of Rooseveltism, and now we've had nearly 30 years of Reaganism, and you can see the difference. During the Rooseveltism, we had a strong middle class and a strong industrial economy, and we were the largest creditor in the world, and we were the largest exporter of finished goods in the world. Under 30 years of Reaganism, we are now the largest importer of finished goods in the world, the largest exporter of raw materials. We are a third world nation. We're the largest debtor in the world. We're broke.
Well, I think
that's a revolution. They took us from being the wealthiest nation in the world to the poorest nation in the world in 26 years. Seems to me like a revolution, not a good one.
Let's do something about it. We the people.
I agree.
Do something about it.
I agree. And we have to do it in the ballot box. This is where I say, you know, instead of getting out in the streets and shooting people, you know, I'm not in favor of violent revolution, but I think
right.
that if we infiltrate the Democratic Party and take it over, much like the crazies did with the Republican Party 30 and 40 years ago, we can turn this country back and put it back on course. Ray, thank you for your call. Michael in Portland. Hey, Michael. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I would just like to point out something about the Trent law, which is that didn't he kind of promise the voters that he was going to be in office for another 7 years.
Yeah, his term ends in 2012, but hey, there's money to be made.
Exactly. And I would hope that the Democrats would run with this because it's just kind of typical of the Republicans. It's like, okay, well, now we got to make a profit. I'm going to quit my job. I'm not going to work for the taxpayers anymore. I'm going to make some money for myself.
Yeah. Yeah. And see, the big, one of the big problems of this is, again, because Reagan did away with Franklin Roosevelt's progressive income tax, where after you made $3.2 million a year in today's dollars, you started paying an income tax rate of 90%. And so there was a natural cap. I mean, it wasn't natural. It was created by the taxes. But there was a cap there on how much people at the very, very top were being paid. That cap has been blown off. And so, you know, everybody who's infected with the mental illness of pathological greed is stampeding into the corporate arena. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
When the paycheck just ain't stretching like it matter once before, cause the good jobs are all gone, left you in some big box store. Between food and rent and medicine, seems the suit's frayed a little bit more. When the boss has cut that last corner, they walk out of those doors. When the truckers hauling sweatshop stuff won't stop there anymore. When the folks won't cross your pickets, cause their boat's the same as yours. That is one big union.
Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Franklin Roosevelt on the topic we've been talking about here. In just a second, we're going to get to Ellen Ratner. But first, Franklin Roosevelt.
For out of this modern civilization, economic royalists carved new dynasties. New kingdoms were built upon concentration of control over material things, through new uses of corporations.
And he goes on about how it came about, and he talks about these economic royalists.
Private enterprise, indeed, became too private. It became privileged enterprise, not free enterprise.
Now, here's the question. Who today in the political arena is talking like this?
These economic royalists complain that we seek to overthrow the institutions of America.
And they call Roosevelt a revolutionary.
What they really complain of is that we seek to take away their power. Our allegiance to American institutions requires the overthrow of this kind of power.
The overthrow of this kind of power. Franklin Roosevelt, 1936 in Philadelphia. Ellen Ratner on the line with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen, what's going on in Washington, D.C.
Right here at the United Nations with Shalene Espinoza. She walked into a little bit of a hornet's nest just asking a regular question. So I'm going to put her on the line, and then I'll go on with some other news.
Okay, great. Hey, Shalene.
Hey, Tom.
Your hornet's nest.
We attended the UNIFEM briefing, which is Say No to Violence Against Women. I don't know if you knew this, but yesterday was the International Day for the Elimination of Violence, and your listeners can actually register on saynotoviolence.org to add their name to a worldwide list to stop violence. But the question was based on something the briefer was saying, that approximately, particularly in Latin America where she was focused, 50% of women experience violence, either sexual abuse or physical violence. And I asked her how those numbers compared to North America, and she said, after a pause, actually, it's the same. So there's an enormous initiative within the United Nations to stop women's violence, and in fact, part of it is that there aren't even laws against these types of crimes against women. There's not funding to care for them after the fact, and not even really any way to track it. And that's what the UN is focusing on. But it seems as though they're reluctant to engage in North American violence due to perhaps political reasons, not her herself, but that's just not the agenda. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
That, yeah, the UN doesn't want to bite the hand that feeds it, basically, is kind of...
Which we can all relate to when you're scrapping for a few crumbs, but at any rate, I was sort of thinking, well, you know, this is being the all-American that I am, I was thinking that, you know, this is an opportunity for us to show that we're actually doing something right, and unfortunately, it's actually just the opposite.
Yeah.
And she said, you know, it may not be as high as 50%, but certainly in the, you know, certainly in the 30 to 50% range, you know, very commensurate with what we're seeing in the rest of the world. And asked her if she, you know, what she attributed, because this is actually an increase, if it was to economic disparity or what was the driving factor in this increase in violence against women. And she said, unfortunately, our tracking mechanisms, you know, anecdotally that seems to be the case, but we don't have a very good way of tracking it.
In one of my books, I think it was Screwed, but it might have been Unequal Protection, I quoted a study that was done in England that the BBC covered very thoroughly, where they looked at conservative versus liberal regimes in the United Kingdom and two other United Kingdom countries. One, I think, was Australia. I forget what the other one was. And over a 100-year period. And what they found was that they were just looking at suicide rates at that time. And what they found was that bringing in a conservative government would raise, in the UK, suicides by about 30,000 people a year.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. It was, you know, quite astounding. Well, because, you know, economics, basically what it did was it increased poverty. And every time a conservative government came in, poverty went up and suicides went up. And every time a Labor government came in, poverty went down and suicides went down. And you can track crime that way. I mean, Rudy Giuliani's running around talking about how he reduced crime in New York City. It's a terrible cliche, but, you know, a rising tide lifts all boats. Let's look then at the Clinton presidency, you know, at that time,
right,
when some reasonable domestic, economic policies were being put into place. Anyway, we have about a half a minute left. What else is going on in the world?
Well, it was interesting. They were talking about the General Assembly. I guess they have an attendance problem in the General Assembly. No one wants to show up.
Really?
I guess if no one listens to you, maybe it's a little bit like the U.S. Congress, and the attendance is pretty lousy. But at any rate, they're trying to, the new U.N. Secretary General is trying to come up with a way to attract people to actually show up for the U.N. General Assembly. And, of course, some of his key agenda items are to actually be effective and to measure the U.N.'s effectiveness on specific results versus, you know, just issuing resolutions and edicts, which is interesting. The other issue was China is sending a bunch of engineers to Darfur, which will help the U.N. peacekeepers, and hopefully they'll turn some of that work into humanitarian assistance as well.
Oh, interesting. Interesting mixed news there. Thank you. Thank you very much, Sholene. Great talking with you today.
Likewise, Tom.
And give our best to Ellen. 57 minutes past the hour.
In the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
And welcome back. The Reverend Barry Lynn has a new book out, or it's actually his book. It came out in hardcover. It's now out in paperback. It just came out. A great gift for this year. It's called Piety in Politics, The Right-Wing Assault on Religious Freedom. His website, AU.org. He's the Executive Director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. AU.org. Reverend Barry Lynn, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Nice to be here.
Great to have you with us, and a tip of the hat to you on writing a great book, doing a great radio show, and all the activism that you're doing on behalf of those of us who believe that religion should have no part, even the religious among us who believe that religion should have no part in governance, in government.
I'd certainly say amen to that. As a religious person myself, obviously, I think one of the reasons we have this separation is to protect the integrity both of government and of religion, and the best way to do it is keep a decent distance between those two institutions.
Yeah, we've been talking for the last couple hours about the economic situation in the United States and how conservative economic philosophy, for lack of a better phrase, I mean, the Europeans call it neoliberalism, which is really what it is, but we don't have that. Most people don't understand what that phrase means here. So Reaganism, let's say, has you know, really whacked the American middle class and the American workers. I saw an article, and I've been trying to remember where it was. It was a week or two ago, and either the New York Times Magazine or Business Week, it was this rather lengthy article about how, or maybe in the New York Times itself, about how some of these mega churches have become major economic forces in the towns that they're in. They're building literally 200 and 300 home subdivisions. They're owning shopping malls. Mm-hmm. All of this on tax-free dollars. They're becoming economic forces in their communities. I was talking earlier about the cancer stage of capitalism, where the cancer being that capitalism reaches out for control of the government and seizes it. And we're seeing this with Trent Lott today retiring so he can become a lobbyist and make a fortune. To what extent are we looking at possibly the cancer stage of religion in relation to government as well?
Well, there's no doubt that religious organizations get tremendous numbers of benefits, tax benefits, exemptions from laws that the rest of us need to apply to ourselves and our own conduct. But what you're talking about also is the tax exemption is not just going for the church or the church school, where you can make an argument that this is a ministry of the church itself, but into everything from corporate developments to real estate developments and shopping malls on the East Coast. And this is a problem that is continuing. At the same time, you have people on the right end of the religious spectrum, that is the incorrect right wing end of it, saying we're being persecuted. David Limbaugh, who I like to refer to as Rush's younger and smarter brother, but he has a book out called Persecution with a lion on the cover, just to remind people that maybe Christians in America are in such a sad shape that they're going to be thrown to the lions like in the days of some of the early Roman emperors. So there's this nonsensical view that Christians are persecuted at the same time that they're getting all kinds of special benefits and also special political power. They love the fact that they've had so much access to Washington over the last 8 years, and they're not going to be giving that up any too easily, even though they haven't coalesced around a single individual presidential candidate.
Yeah. Well, this is again that cancer stage. I was quoting Franklin Roosevelt earlier, where he said, you know, this kind of concentration of power, where the power reaches out to seize control of government itself, is a dangerous thing. In fact, he went on to talk about, again, he was talking about economic power, but, you know, I'd like to bring this to religious power, but let me just share this very short clip
with
you. This is Franklin Roosevelt, 36.
They seek to hide.
Let's try it again. And for some reason, it is not playing. There we go.
In vain, they seek to hide behind the flag and the Constitution. But in their blindness, they forget what the flag and the Constitution stand for.
And then he goes on to say that, you know, now, as always, they stood for, against mob rule and rule by the overprivileged alike. And now we can add to this the rule of the religious.
No, absolutely. You know, big organizations do tend to puff themselves up and think of themselves as tremendously important. In the case of the religious right, which represents about 18% of the American electorate and has for about, the good news is it hasn't grown much since 1972 or 73, but it's 18%. That's not to be sneezed at. They have the capacity, as they did here in Washington about a month ago, to get every Republican candidate for the presidency to come and speak to a convention that was held here, a so-called Values Voter Summit. And at the same time, People on the Democratic side are using religion sometimes in ways that simply affirm that they have a faith and they're not ashamed of it, and they say that. But in some cases, using it a little more extensively, as if they're trying to proof text progressive politics from the Bible instead of right-wing beliefs that have been also proof texted by the right wingers from the Bible. And we have to recognize that in this country, you know, we don't have Bible quoting contests, so we have presidential debates. They're supposed to talk about how we resolve questions more than they talk about the source of your values. But I think most of your listeners and mine on my show understand that the people, Democrats and Republicans, have values. They care about values, and it's okay to talk about values. It's just not so important to discuss how many times you've gone to church. Maybe you remember when Fred Thompson got into this race, there was this obsessive media interest in how many times he went to church. And they found out he went more frequently in Tennessee than when he's up here living in his home in suburban Washington. What they should have asked, I think, is how many times did Senator Fred Thompson go to visit veterans in VA hospitals after their return from Iraq? That's a relevant question in a secular democracy. Right. How many times a guy went to church or what he thinks of the preaching is not relevant to choosing a commander-in-chief.
Right, or if you wanted to put it in a religious context, let's distill out the essence of religion and ask him how many times he visited the sick, how many times he cared for the homeless, how many times he fed the hungry.
You got it. Those are issues that transcend individual religious traditions and, in fact, are, in a sense, part and parcel of almost every religious tradition you
can
find.
Even beyond religious tradition, you find, you know, atheists embrace these values, agnostics embrace these values, animists embrace these. These transcend any little category. We're talking with Reverend Barry Lynn. He's the executive director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, AU.org. Their website is new. His book is out in paperback now, newly out in paperback, Piety and Politics, The Right-Wing Assault on Religious Freedom. Barry, you look at government endorsement of religious symbols and suggest that they actually harm genuine faith.
Absolutely. For at least two reasons. One, sometimes, unfortunately, churches decide that if there's a nativity scene, for example, up at this season of the year at City Hall, they don't have to bother to put one up on their church lawn, because the government's doing it for them. That's a very dangerous occupation, to believe that the government should do or can do and can replace what you, the church, do. And then the other thing is, every time that governments tend to promote religion, they tend to cheapen it. I mean, if you look at some of the awful, awful nativity scenes that are put up in cities, county governments, state houses around the country, you'd be appalled at just what they look like. In fact, for a while, the National Mall here in Washington had this display where they had a nativity scene right next to a cage that said Santa's reindeer. Yeah. So the average person coming, you know, who didn't know anything about it either, would think, oh, I guess there are two religions. One is Santa Claus, and one has to do with this plastic baby.
Well, they are two religions. Yeah, they really are. But and we have about 30 seconds left here, Barry Lynn. We're in the season for the war on Christmas. Why doesn't anybody ever discuss the war on Hanukkah? It seems to me that that's the real war that's going on. The conservatives want only Christianity to be discussed.
They
this
do want only Christianity, Tom. You're absolutely right. And the point is, as soon as you do anything, for example, there was a Hindu who gave a prayer for the first time in the history of Congress. Guess who stood up? Christians in the gallery and protested it, got themselves arrested. The people who said, oh, we like all religions, what they meant was, we like ours, nobody else's.
Yeah, and they want theirs to be in charge.
Of course.
The Reverend Barry Lynn, AU.org, the website, the book Piety and Politics, The Right-Wing Assault on Religious Freedom. Thanks so much for being with us, Reverend.
Thanks, Tom.
Good talking to you. 16 minutes past the hour.
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
You were living in a modern world. Calling America, taking the best of calling.
21 minutes past the hour, fitting in just absolutely perfectly with our conversation throughout most all of this day, which is, you know, the deregulation of America, the end of the New Deal that came, that began with the election of Ronald Reagan, when Limbaugh came out and said,
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
Destroying unions, destroying the social safety net, perhaps most significantly deregulating industries like the mortgage industry and the banking industry. Well, now, on behalf of working people in the United States, many of the labor unions out there are starting to get active in these political realms and saying, wait a minute, wait a minute. Terry O'Sullivan on the line with us, the general president of the Laborers International Union of North America, LIUNA, LIUNA.org, their website. Hey, Terry.
How you doing, Tom? Always great to be with you.
Well, just great to have you here, Terry. Thank you. You guys have announced your most aggressive effort yet to protect workers' pension funds and begin restoring confidence and accountability of the mortgage industry and housing market. Tell me about this.
Well, this effort includes shareholder proposals, Tom, at 28 different corporations. As you know and you've said, I mean, there's as many as a million residential construction workers who are going to lose their jobs. Up to 3 million homeowners face foreclosure, and hundreds of billions of dollars in shareholder value has been destroyed because of a system that's riddled with conflicts of interest, lack of disclosure, and a lack of oversight. And we decided as a union that we can't idly stand by as workers' pensions get hammered, jobs and homes are lost, and our economy falls into a downward slide.
Yeah. And so you're going before 28 corporations as shareholders and putting forward proposals to do what?
Well, actually, they fall into three categories. One about additional disclosure, proposals to help investors better understand existing and future mortgage security risk. I mean, with all this packaging of mortgage-backed securities, investors were buying these packages of securities and didn't know, what percentage of them were subprime loans, Alt-A loans, or prime loans. And we believe that there needs to be better disclosure going forward. The second issue, type of proposal that we're filing are proposals that will deal with CEO compensation, if you will, pay for performance, and succession planning. We as a union, we have $32 billion in our members' pension holdings that are invested in corporate America, companies that are going through this downturn in the economy and through this mortgage crisis. CEOs are being fired. We want to make sure that as shareholders in those companies that there are succession plans and that CEO compensation is tied to performance. I use Robert Toll from Toll Brothers, which is a national builder, as an example. He got $20 million last year, and the value of the company has gone down 75%.
Yes,
we don't believe that those are sound policies and that shareholders should have a say in executive compensation and that executives should be paid appropriately for performance.
Yeah, somehow I doubt, too, that all the guys who made millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions, maybe billions, hustling these subprime mortgages are going to have to pay back that money as their companies go bankrupt and go down in flames.
And the third one, Tom, is proposals to limit and disclose conflict of interest between the credit rating agencies and the mortgage buyers and sellers who pay for those agency services. Long and short, we believe that Moody's and S&P that actually are the rating agencies, that there's too cozy of a relationship with the Wall Street underwriters.
Right.
And we believe that those conflicts of interest need to be disclosed, and that there needs to be more regulation in the industry.
Yeah, I was just going to say, Terry, it sounds to me like everything you're calling for here with these shareholder proposals are really things that Congress should be passing.
And Barney Frank, Tom, has there's actually been a bill that passed in the House that we're supportive of. It's going to have difficulty getting passed in the Senate, and certainly, ever be signed off by this president. But it is Congress needs to step in here. I mean, this credit crisis, we haven't seen the worst of it yet. And it's going to affect those at the bottom end and the middle end of the economic ladder a lot worse than those at the top end. And we think that there needs to be federal regulatory oversight of the credit industry, and we need to learn from this horrific lesson that is affecting working people throughout this country.
Yeah. Amen. We're talking with Terry O'Sullivan, the general president of the Laborers International Union of North America, liuna.org, their website. Terry, has your union endorsed a presidential candidate?
At this point in time, we have not. We have polled our members, our membership once. None of the Democratic presidential candidates have gotten the needed 60% for us to make an endorsement. Mm-hmm. We will be doing another membership poll in December. And at the point at which one of the candidates gets 60%, that's the point at which we would consider an endorsement.
Yeah, because it seems to me like you're calling for basically a populist reformation in the United States.
Without a doubt. There needs to be a worker revolution in this country, Tom. And our union and organized labor is ready, willing, and able to lead it.
Amen. Okay, good on you. Terry O'Sullivan, LIUNA, LIUNA.org, the Laborers International Union of North America. Terry is the general president. Terry, thanks for dropping by today.
Thanks again for having me, Tom.
Always great having you on. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We'll be back with your calls, 866-303-2270, right after this.
Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Hey, just a quick heads up. This Thursday and Friday, I'll be in Los Angeles and Oak Park, California. Thursday night, the 29th. Yeah, that is a Thursday, isn't it? Thursday night at 7:30, I'll be at the Barnes & Noble on 3rd Street in Santa Monica, actually. And on Friday night, Oak Park, California, I'll be at the Ventura County Democrats Speaker Series from 7 to 9 p.m. That's on Cannon Road in Oak Park. You can get information about that over at our website, tomhartman.com. Also on December 14th coming up, I'll be in Minneapolis, Minnesota. We'll be doing our show live from our affiliate there. Plus, we'll be at the University of Minnesota Bookstore at Kauffman Memorial Union with Air America Minnesota. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And George, you first of all, you've been on hold for a long time. Thanks for holding. And you're saying I don't get libertarianism.
Right. I've had some gin, so I hope I can be lucid.
Okay.
It's been a couple hours, so...
It has, and I thank you for holding.
Okay. Well, anyway, I think you don't understand the underlying principles of libertarianism, and that has to do more with philosophy. And the principle is non-coercion. Do not use force or fraud against another person.
Right.
So economics and the foreign policy that Ron Paul have simply derive from that principle.
Right. But here's the question. If it's you as an individual with a limited lifetime and limited wealth are up against a corporation which can live forever, can accumulate unlimited wealth, and has, you know, millions of dollars in lawyers that it can throw at you, is that an equal... You know, is it not conceivable to you that there may be some economic coercion or other forms of coercion, for that matter, for example, slap suits, that corporation can engage in against you that you could not engage in against that corporation?
Well, when you use the word coercion, you have to be careful. You're telling me that people really don't have a choice but to succumb to that corporation.
Yes.
I don't believe that.
Well, what I'm saying is that when there is a supply of labor that equals or exceeds the demand for labor, then yes, people have no choice but to take whatever jobs are available to them.
Right. Now that is a problem, and I won't make the claim that laissez-faire capitalism always works the best. In fact, I won't make that claim. I believe that a somewhat regulated economy works better.
Then you're not a libertarian.
Well, in principle, I am.
You're taking my position here, George.
Well, let me tell you, I'm a soft libertarian. I prefer you know, most libertarians
There's no such thing!
Listen for a second. Most libertarians are more Republican-leaning, right?
Well, I call libertarians Republicans who want to smoke dope and get laid.
Right. Well, I prefer Democrats to Republicans, okay, because I'm more concerned about national security, the heaviness of national security, and also the imperialism of foreign policy. So I'm more of a Democrat.
Okay, George, yeah, you're not.
Wait a minute. But one more thing. When you talk about Ronald Reagan.
Yes, sir.
And you say that he's the one who started deregulation. You do that in a disparaging way, but I will say Jimmy Carter deserves the credit.
Jimmy Carter started. You're absolutely right.
Jimmy Carter
deregulated the trucking industry and deregulated the airlines industry. Yeah,
right. He appointed Paul Volcker to kick inflation down, and Reagan is given credit for all this, but really it's Jimmy Carter. I'm not a total fan of Jimmy Carter, but he should be given a lot more credit. It was a watershed moment during his presidency. He started that.
You're absolutely right, George. And there was also a Supreme Court decision back there in the 70s that basically said that money is speech and corporations are persons, and therefore they can participate in the political arena, rolling back the law that Teddy Roosevelt put into place in 1907, and as I recall. And that's a factor in it as well. But
people make fun of Jimmy Carter, but he knew more than people thought.
Yeah,
he made a mistake in the Camp David agreement. He caved in to the demands of Israel. He kind of screwed the Palestinians. So I don't appreciate that. Yeah, but economic wise, he was better than Reagan.
Okay, thank you, George. And speaking of that, I mean that's a road that is awful hard to do in a soundbite. But there is one sound. Here we have this accord coming up. This Annapolis meeting coming up. And the thing that astounds me is that the average American doesn't realize that the real issue here, fundamentally, and actually there's a reasonably good op-ed piece about this in today's Wall Street Journal, is whether or not the survival of Israel is on the table. And I would submit to you, and having spent a lot of time in Israel and having spent a fair amount of time in some of the Arab states around Israel in my life, that one of the reasons why several of these states in this area that have large numbers of Palestinian refugees in them will not grant citizenship to those Palestinians is that they're just, they're taking the unofficial, and it used to be official position, now it's a little less official, now it's in code, position that eventually they're going to just wipe Israel off the map, that, to do away with the Jewish state, and there will be a full right of return. Right of return is the code phrase. And as long as that position is being held by even some of the participants in this thing, it's not going to go anywhere. And I don't know why this isn't being discussed more, but anyway. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary.
Hi, Tom. An observation and talk about philosophy, a quote about the philosophy of Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Yes, sir.
But, Tom, I have to tell you, you truly are a great patriotic American and one of the few, in my opinion, who has it figured out.
Well, to some small extent. Gary, thank you very much.
Wait,
did you have something you wanted to share?
Please?
Yes, sir.
Thanks. We're not just at the beginning of in a cancer. We're flat out in a cancer. When I last talked to you, I used that same word. That this is an unprecedented cancer of culture, of unregulated greed over principle and priorities, and we can't go on like this. And Franklin Delano Roosevelt, he said it best, you're so damn right, we need an FDR, FDR, and I'll make it quick, said this, and I quote Franklin Delano Roosevelt, government can err, presidents can make mistakes, but we are told that divine justice weighs the sins of the cold-blooded and the sins of the warm-hearted on a different scale. Better the occasional fall of government living in the spirit of charity than the consistent omissions of a government frozen in the ice of its own indifference.
Right, that's from the same speech I was quoting earlier, his 1936 acceptance speech
right,
in Philadelphia.
That's my favorite one. Thanks for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you, Gary. It's good to hear from you. Franklin Roosevelt. And there we go.
I see one-third of a nation ill housed, ill clad, ill-nourished.
Annie in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Annie.
Hi. Thanks for having me on, Tom. How are you?
Fine. What's up?
Hi. So I'm calling. I work with the steering committee of the Engage committee that you had Raymond Lada and Samsara called in earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of Samsara's call-in, you said you made the point about get specific, and I just wanted to say two things. One, this is exactly the kind of debate and discussion that our committee is committed to kind of kicking off in society, and we think the more people from all different perspectives engage because he is doing unique stuff, the more that'll give rise to the ferment and discussion needed.
Right. Go ahead.
Sorry. Oh, I was just going to point people in terms of some of the specifics of his work to, there's a lot of stuff from him that people could download at bobavakian.net. And
yeah.
I think.
See, that's the problem though, Annie. You're never going to create a revolution by saying go to a website and download a bunch of stuff. And here you've got a guy who back in 1981 got busted for protesting against Jimmy Carter and Deng Xiaoping coming to the United mm-hmm. States, and decided rather than dealing with that to flee the country. And so he's not even around the United States. I don't get it. I mean, why not have somebody, why not yourself or Samsara or, you know, our guests? I mean, why not have somebody stand up and say, I'm the one who's taking these positions? Why do we have to have some distant, it's almost like it reminds me of, you know, one of the political cults of the last couple of centuries. It's like, you know, oh, there's this guy out there and he's so wise and we just need to follow what he says. What's wrong with saying, hey, here's what I believe. Damn it. This is what we should do.
Well, look, I think it's a really important question. I think, one, if people read his memoir, they'll see why he left the country, and he discusses that very openly.
No, but what do you think that we should do?
Well, I'm answering what you raised, right, because I actually think you raised things that are worth engaging. So that was one thing in terms of in 1981. Two, no one's in hiding. This is something you said earlier. No one's in hiding, and I think if people actually understand the way this government has treated
him. Then where is he? What's his address?
Well, I'll answer the question. If I think people understand the way the U.S. government has treated revolutionary leaders throughout history and the ways in which they're ramping up their repressive measures today, which you do some exposure on, then I think people can understand why people are not actually engaged to concern themselves with his whereabouts, but get into his work. Now, I myself am both somebody who is a supporter of I am also a revolutionary communist, and then I also work in this committee with people, again, from different perspectives. Don't agree with everything he's saying, but think his voice needs to be engaged. And then you've had Samsara on. I mean, she'll certainly tell you what she thinks, as will Raymond Lada, who writes extensively about revolution and communism.
Yeah. I just think as long as you guys are trying to turn this into a cult of personality about a guy who won't even be in this country, that it's not going to go anywhere. What you need to do, if I may respectfully suggest, is say, here's the 5 points, or here's our action steps, and you know, here's where we want to go. But I may be wrong.
Have us on again, Tom, and we can do that.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Annie.
Okay.
Good talking
thank
with you.
You. Take
45
care.
Minutes past the hour.
Goes the last DJ who plays what he wants to play and says what he wants to say. Hey, hey, hey.
Yeah, here he is. That's how I started in this business. 17 years old, 1968. I started out doing country music and then did rock and roll and all night progressive cuts. Last DJ right here. 1-866-303-2270, your phone number. Ed in San Diego, California. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. My kind of program. I just wanted to call attention to the fact that while you were talking in the first hour, I was holding in my hand a book that, of course, Upton Sinclair's The Jungle. It's been republished, and the new foreword on it is by Eric Schlosser, and it sounded like, since I just got through reading it, it sounded like you 100%. I wanted to bring that to your attention.
As I recall, The Jungle was like something that I was exposed to in high school, and I frankly don't remember if I read the book or if I read the Cliff Notes version. That's the book that exposed the meatpacking industry and all that kind of stuff?
In Chicago, correct.
Yeah. Yeah, and led to the creation of the Pure Food Acts and the Food and Drug Administration and the USDA and whatnot.
Teddy Roosevelt, right.
Yeah, yeah, interesting.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Ed, and thanks for letting us know that it's back out again. That's great. Ben in Oregon. Hey, Ben, what's up?
Good morning, Tom. I totally agree with what you said about Congress being able to regulate some of these industries that are just running amok. We had controls over them. We need to elect people that have the guts to stand up and do that. And we need to get more people, more progressive people elected to Congress.
Yeah, amen, Ben. That's only half the problem, though. The other half of the problem is that to some arguable extent, and I realize that, this sounds very wishy-washy, but to some arguable extent, many members of Congress are playing the game because they are in districts where enormous amounts of money are necessary to buy the media necessary to win an election. And so they're caught in this god-awful situation where they've got to go along with the corporations in order to get the money from the corporations so they can then hand that money off to other corporations that have to be media corporations. And it's like you got to go get along to go along. And the way to break that cycle is with public financing of elections like we have here in Portland, Oregon. And until we break that cycle, until we get money out of the elections, it's, you know, yes, we can do this. And it's just, that's wrong. There's just something fundamentally wrong about a situation like that. So I think that public financing has to be right up there at the top of the list, too. And that's, in the Green Party, is really the major force for that. And so I encourage people to participate in that. Make sense, Ben?
Well, yes, it does. I believe that you're right on that public financing also, but not all corporations are bad, and I think we can use corporations in this country to do business.
Oh, I'm all in favor of corporations existing. I'm just not in favor of their participating in politics. If a corporation wants to lobby, for example, then let them ask their employees to talk to the, and I would say this is the same is true of unions. I mean, let's just treat everybody equally and say individuals can lobby their members of Congress. Institutions cannot. And just leave it at that. I mean, that's the direction that I would take it. Ben, thanks a lot for the call. Mark in New Mexico. Hey, Mark.
Tom, I just want to say you've got the patience of a saint to allow these well-meaning communists to try and convince us that we should.
But see, Mark, it's well-meaning well-meaning idealists who have begun every major positive transformation in the history of this country.
Yes. You're right.
So let's not dismiss people who are utopianists on the right or the left, frankly. I think that the Ron Paul crowd are absolutely wrong, you know, the libertarians.
Yeah.
And I'm just astounded by, you know, for example, you know, well, we'll get into that tomorrow, but I think that they're wrong, but I think that we need to acknowledge their idealism.
Okay, I agree with you on that. But I have a question. And I'm old enough to remember the savings and loan debacle that the Bush family brought us.
Right.
And I don't remember exactly how much it cost the taxpayers.
I think it was $400
million. Bail out the greedy bankers. But I have a sickly feeling that the same thing is going to happen with these mortgage bankers who have been swindling poor people. Are we going to have to bail them out too?
Yep. Meet the new Bush, same as the old Bush.
Yeah.
That's what it is. Mark, thanks a lot for the call. Joe in Denver. Hey, Joe.
Hi, Tom. I was wondering, in terms of specifics about the communism idea, what do you think about the idea that CEOs or the highest paid people in a corporation would only be able to make something very limited, like maybe two times what the lowest paid person in a corporation would make?
Well, that's how it works in the civil service system. It's how it works in the Army. That's how it's worked in most universities up until the past 20 years or so. And now they say they have to compete with the corporate world. And that's frankly how it used to work, simply as a direct and natural consequence of progressive taxation, where you had a top tax rate between 70% and 90% for people who made over $3.5 million a year. And, you know, then you have that as a sort of a natural ceiling. And that's, I think, frankly, a healthy thing. I think serious progressive taxation was a healthy thing for America. And when Reagan did away with it in 81, then it really started taking apart this country. It really did serious damage to the country. And so anyway, that's where we've got to go with it. Emery in Venice, California. Hey, Emery.
Hey,
just about out of time here.
Okay. First of all, let me just say that I'm not a communist, but the first communist revolution in the world was definitely democracy, and it's been very successful in America for 200 years until the robber barons get involved.
Yeah, but let me just say, good point. Emery, I'm sorry, we're out of time, but I would argue that the first communist revolution in the world was a couple thousand years ago. We can get into that some other time. Coming up tomorrow on the Tom Hartman program, I'll be challenging Kathleen Willey. Yes, the one who says Bill Clinton groped her on her new book, Target, Caught in the Crosshairs of Bill and Hillary Clinton. Plus the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman program, your radio support group for We the People. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This
is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.